Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you'd like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We'd also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review, as it will help others to learn about autism stories. On today's episode, Danny, known as the Punk Rock Autistic, joins me. We have a really great discussion that lasted a lot longer than many of the episodes here on Autism Stories. So we're going to turn this into two separate episodes. The first part of this episode will be today, in which Danny joins me to discuss autonomy and their work as a consultant supporting neurodivergent individuals. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Danny, thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a privilege to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
And I wanted to just start off by learning, where does your story in the autistic community begin?
That's a really good question. It's one of those things. It's been kind of like a gradual process over the past 15 years, and it's kind of looked, it's had different appearances in different contexts and different avenues over the years. But I mean, I'm being autistic myself, you know, I would say my entire life, but I would also say that, like, more so in my adult life, when I was, I'm almost 35 now. And when I was 22, I started working in direct support roles, like within group homes and education and in like one-on-one care. And I think that that's like really where that entry point with the community really started, was from that. And then over time, as I was working in that field, different positions and whatnot. And I worked in day programs for autistic folks and developmentally disabled folks who had kind of higher support needs for a very long period of time. And that's kind of where my own self-diagnosis kind of came from, because I grew up in very exclusive, exclusionary education. I had an IEP and probably definitely should have gotten diagnosed way back then, but all through, you know, school, surrounded by peers such as ourselves. But it wasn't until I worked in those fields that I started to kind of put the pieces together that, oh, there's something here going on that I relate to deeply. From there, when I got my own diagnosis, I was already wading in the waters of surrounded by autistic people constantly, you know, 40 hours a week. But then online, I found a couple of Facebook groups, maybe about five or six years ago, right when like the neurodiversity stuff really started to pick up online. And I was involved in that and admin and modded a lot of groups, and that was really helpful with me kind of being able to have more information, a firsthand perspective of other autistic people, to kind of learn more about myself and to better accommodate myself and to better advocate for myself. And then from there, I just saw a lot of things that inspired me. And as much as I love the work that I did, if I look back in retrospect, all of the organizations I worked for had their intentions were great, and a lot of them had phenomenal employees and phenomenal programs that treated their, you know, their residents or clients or students or participants, whatever you want to call it, very, very well. But there was still a very underlying foundational problem of ableism, because the people who were operating these places weren't ran by people who had those firsthand experiences, so they could only go so far. And I had a couple of clients who were non-speaking, and I went through a period, even when I do now with my training, I help and train people on using AAC boards and technology for non-speaking folks. And that's really when I kind of started to piece the picture together. I'm like, you know what, I need to do something outside of this and start doing something that I can engage directly with the community as a firsthand perspective. And that's when I started my page, and that's when I started my business. And that was about 2 years ago or so now. So, yeah.
So were you a communication regulation partner for some folks?
Yeah. So I did a lot of like direct support sort of things. I did a lot of respite. I did a lot of in-home care for one-on-one sort of, well, like I said, a lot of direct support stuff. But outside of that, I got a lot of training for, like, I'm not an occupational therapist, I'm not a speech therapist, but I got training from them, and then would go into people's homes with like a one-on-one with, like, you know, somebody who was getting access through, you know, whatever government assistance they got to, like, to get access to these, like, you know, to I the particular tablets and stuff in schools or at home, and I would train them on how to use the parents on how to use them.
Now, kind of talking about direct support, in the last few months or so, you've started to provide neurodiversity-focused consulting services to individuals and families with an emphasis on person-centered and trauma-informed care, which is so critical. Yeah. Something that really relates to that I think about is self-autonomy. How have you tried to support people in thinking about this autonomy with those that you've consulted with so far?
The way that I'm doing, like, my individualized, like, consulting services is there, I meet with a lot of different individuals, and a lot of times some of the individuals I work with directly are, you know, newly diagnosed adults or people who are coming to the realization of through self-diagnosis that they might be autistic but want more information on it. And then it's also, like, with parents and, like, their kids, it kind of takes a lot of different forms. When I first meet with somebody, one of the things that I really try to emphasize through person-centered care and trauma-informed care is, in a lot of those words and that terms and that system, I take from my experience of working as a case manager, where I was working with very high-risk, high-sensitive individuals with very, very profound and significant mental illness. And one of the things that I've taken from that is that no matter the person's, like, individualized situation, if we aren't working with somebody and coming from them and meeting them at their, like, at their needs and their foundation, and rather than, like, having them accommodate us and, like, we accommodate them and meeting them in their home and in their space where they're comfortable and allowing them to dictate what they want, allowing them to lead. And I have a lot of work that I do, but it's very personalized, and it's very, if someone is looking to develop a firmer, a better understanding on what it means to be autistic or what that looks like for their kid or ways that they can advocate for them, my entire focus is, rather than looking at it as something that needs to be changed within a person, it's like, what can we change for that person to make life easier for them? So a lot of my inspiration from this comes from when I worked in direct support. While I wasn't directly working with ABA, there was a lot of behavioralist kind of jargon that was, like, really fused into a lot of the stuff that we did. And this kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier, that there's this systemic problem where we're looking at individualists through a behavioralist kind of perspective, where we're separating the person from their challenges, right? That their challenges are coming from within and everything is a reaction, when it's really the other way around, that these things are environmental factors. They're things that we can address external from the person that can help what that person is dealing with internally. And rather than trying to create a way of looking at the person as a problem, right, which a lot of the system problems do, is looking at, like, this autism isn't something to be cured. This is something that we need to then fix the world that they live in to adapt them. Because autistic people, you know, I've seen this around a lot lately, is that we are constantly trying to accommodate this neurotypical world that isn't created for us, right, where we're putting all the effort because we're the ones who are expected to adapt. Whereas this world was created in a sense that wasn't inclusive to disabled people. And my goal with person-centered care is to then meet them on their terms and then us accommodate them. And what I think is really important is, if we are going to provide systems, and this is what I think it gives me an advantage from what I do in my job compared to a lot of other places, especially locally, which creates a lot of challenge because I have a lot of competition, but is that all of these organizations and people who are doing similar things that I'm doing aren't ran by people who have that first-hand experience. It's like, if you look at a lot of nonprofits with DEIs, like disability, accessibility, inclusion sort of boards, right? They often don't have any representation of people who have that firsthand lived experience. And for me, that's such a vital role, because how can you provide to a community who's already marginalized and disenfranchised if you haven't first had that direct experience? How can you create the systems that lead the charge of making that accommodation change on a larger level if you're not meeting them? I guess to make my very long answer a little bit shorter is that, for me, everybody has their own challenges. Everybody's out of their own experiences, and every, like, expression of those challenges and manifestations, be that through trauma, be that through not developing skills of how to regulate in a way that's healthy and safe, or not knowing, you know, fundamentally what it means to be autistic. It's like meeting that these aren't behaviors, these are, it's a form of communication. They're not behaviors or communications. If I'm working with a parent whose kid is non-speaking and can be very self-injurious or very destructive to their environment, there's something that's triggering that, and looking at it is like, that's the problem, not them. I think it's just a different perspective of consciousness of how we work with individuals than unfortunately is the norm. So I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Absolutely. When you hear the word behavior, what is the first thing that comes to your mind?
Oh, I cringe a little bit. It's kind of a triggering word for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, growing up in the system that I did, I was kind of the poster child for the autistic ADHD, you know, Ritalin generation of the 90s. You know, I was put in every sort of like behavioral intervention, or, you know, I like using the word accommodating education, but back then it was definitely special education. I was viewed as a problem. Everything was viewed as like, oh, that's inappropriate. Like, don't act that way. Why are you behaving this way? It was very much a manipulative, gaslighting, kind of controlling sort of environment from every factor, every angle. And so it brings up a lot of pain and a lot of anxiety. And I've done a lot of work to kind of work through that in order to help other people. But I think for a lot of us, I've always said that every autistic person has trauma. You know, I think PTSD is a rampant thing for all of us. And it's really because of that being viewed as like a problem that needs to be corrected. And I think that is horribly problematic. And that's so, yeah, when I hear behavior, I cringe thoroughly.
You were talking about your consulting and working with people and parents, mm-hmm. and all that. And from what I understand, you filled up your availability in terms of working with people pretty quickly in a short period of time, which I'm wondering for maybe consultants and coaches out there that are looking to support autistics or other autistic people, what would your advice be to them if they're looking for more clients to use their services?
I think there's a slight correction there. I'm actually still looking for clients. My availability is full in one aspect. So it's not just like personalized individual consulting that I do. I also do like accommodation training for like businesses. And I've also been hired by a couple universities to kind of be their perspective, like consultant for their autism research, which is awesome because there's a lot of, you know, medical research that's being done that doesn't include people in the community to look over and be like, hey, is this the right way of doing it? But as far as like individual stuff, if people are watching this and are interested, this is my self plug, still looking for people, absolutely. But if I were to give any advice, is I guess it depends on who we're speaking. If we're talking about someone who's doing similar work and they're like neurotypical, right? My advice would be is to fully engage with the autistic and neurodiverse community to get their perspective and their education on things. Maybe look into people who are in similar roles but might have that experience, such as myself, or there's so many other people. I would also advise looking into becoming educated on the fact that, like, I'm very white and cis passing. I'm not, but, you know, I definitely have that privilege. And I think that there's a lot of people in our community who aren't spoken for or spoken over by those in the biased fitting majority, such as myself. People like people of color and indigenous folks, like they need to have a higher platform and perspective because their experiences with autism are very different from the folks who look like you and I. So my advice would be, if you like they're neurotypical, to really engage with the community and kind of get a better understanding. But then if they're looking to build more clients, that's something I'm still like kind of figuring out. But I think that having access to social media is really, really important to be able to engage with the community and kind of show up and be like alongside us in solidarity, that like, hey, what I'm doing is like a representative of the community. I'm getting the perspective and viewpoints and experience from those I'm directly serving. I think that's really critical. There's a couple of people, organizations that I've come across who have similar sort of accessibility, accommodation, or diverse training, but they don't have the representation of those who are part of the community they're claiming to serve. And I would really, really, really stress the importance of hiring autistic people to consult for your consulting. if the person themselves on the other side is neurodivergent, one of the things that I would recommend is, if you're probably already part of the community, is to network, is to reach out to other folks, say, you know, having a website, I think, is a really, really crucial step of having some sort of, be it through social media, be it through a separate site, be it somewhere where people can find you and know what you do, list what you're doing. And I don't see this as a competitive sort of thing. I think that everybody has a different perspective to offer. When I meet other people who are in similar roles as myself, I don't see this as a competition. I see them as like in solidarity. Like, networking is really important. I have other consultants that I talk to who are also like big people on Facebook or social media who run advocacy pages. It's like, you know, they're offering a different perspective than I am, or a different avenue is to work with them directly. And the most important thing is to give yourself patience. I find that a lot of my own challenges might mirror that of other people, is that we have a tendency to be very impatient and want results very quickly. We want to engage and build something, because all of us have this like very, a lot of us have a very profound sense of like justice and like knowing that something's wrong and we need to do the right thing and assist others. You know, this whole stereotype that autistic people can't feel empathy is like so far from the truth. And I think that that can have a tendency to burn us out very quickly if we bite off more than we can chew. And I know that I've fallen in those pitfalls. And for me, the most important thing of like being able to continue the work and have it grow is to be able to give yourself time to rest and recover. Mm-hmm. Eventually, what I'm going to do once I get around and have the spoons is I'm actually going to create a portal on my site as a free resource of how to get engaged into becoming a self-advocate online, or to start a blog, or to start a consulting thing. Because I really encourage people to get into this. I think that having the ability to express your own challenges with a community and to then help others also can give your sense of self like a higher sense of validation when other people are validated by your own experiences. It's like a very synergetic relationship. And I think it can be beneficial for people to kind of take that path if that's what they choose. So be on the lookout for that. I'm definitely eventually going to be working that avenue.
I think when you do have the spoons, because you've developed a really nice following on social media, I think that would be really helpful to yeah. others for sure. I did want to ask mm-hmm. you about networking, though, because when I used to hear the word networking, I kind of cringed, kind of the way, you know, you talked about behavior, and I kind of feel that same way about behavior, but I feel that same way about networking. And then until I kind of like realized, like, I don't have to network by going to like these in-person events that are overwhelming and things like that. You know, networking for me is, I now do it based on my preferred method of communication. And usually a lot of that takes place online. So I'm wondering for you, like, what does networking look like?
So I have not yet had any sort of like in-person sort of networking experience in regards to like what I do for my own business and my own advocacy stuff. Everything is completely online. While I have worked with people locally, as far as, you know, engaging in the work that I do critically, I haven't gone to any sort of event or anything. I've been invited to them by people that I've met through what I do. You know, I've made friends through people that the work that I do on a local level, on a national level. And I've been invited to a couple times to, you know, be at working with on a local level for like law policy and things like that for advocacy and, you know, expanding ADA in Colorado. And I could be a part of that, but I have to do it online. So for me, networking it started really of like really engaging with the people that have engagement on my page. If you look, I do my best to try to respond to as many comments as I can and engage with people and have open dialogue and conversation. The other thing is like when people either find out about me through word of mouth or through my site or through my social media, as I start to develop that sort of like relationship with them, often they will, you know, reach out to other family members. Right now, one of the things that I'm trying to do is grow further in working with employers and working with educators of training. I've got a lot of like PowerPoints that I'm working on and like creating like a training session of neurodiversity, like accommodations in the workplace, or just like what neurodiversity is in general and how can we, you know, create a sustainable and accommodating environment for people, is like reaching out on local level. Like I'll send emails and like hit up like local like school districts or nonprofits here to offer my services to them. it's really just kind of, I've made a joke that like my networking is really just following the dopamine, like wherever it takes me. So if it's, you know, engaging with people online, or if it's like, oh, I know of this like really cool organization that's around locally, I'll send them an email and kind of just be like, hey, these are the things I offer. I've also noticed that there are a couple of groups here in my local area who provide similar services, but they're using very outdated language or symbolism, the things that like us as the greater like autistic and the disability community probably wouldn't consider to be very accommodating or intersectional. And I've sent them information of alternatives to use that are like preferred and accepted by the community. And in turn, they're like, oh, wow, this is really great information. Would you like want to work with me? And it's, while I don't do a lot of the impersonal things, my preferred communication is online as well. And I think that just, it's very spontaneous. Whatever kind of pops up, I'll engage with and interact with. And then they'll find somebody else and then I'll hear from them. And it's, I don't know, kind of just put my feelers out whenever I get an opportunity to.
Yeah, I like that. Networking is following the dopamine. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's your individual consulting or your business consulting, how can people learn more about you beyond this interview and about your services?
So you can find me on my website, which is just very simply thepunkrockautistic.com. Within my site, I have a space for just like the articles that I write. I'm currently working on a book, and I occasionally, when I have the spoons for it, will, you know, write my articles and share them on my website. And then there's also a resource link on my page that I've been building up to other sorts of forms of education where people can learn more about the things that we're talking about through other means of other people. I really try to build up like other pages and creators and who are doing similar things so that they can get the engagement as well, because I really firmly believe that solidarity is super important in our community. And then on the other side, there's a direct link to my consulting page on my website. So that would be the punkrockautistic.com/consulting that has all of the services that are available. The way that generally works is that if someone reaches out to me, I send them like kind of like an orientation welcome packet, which is a short assessment to get a better idea of like what services they're looking for, to learn more about that person. And then from there, if we mutually feel like it's a good fit, we'll continue and do a free 30-minute consultation to kind of get to know each other better. And if it feels like it's something we want to move forward to, then we'll do the actual services. You can also find me on Facebook, just simply the Punk Rock Autistic. I'm on Instagram as well, under the same handle, but I don't often really use Instagram. Usually my website and Facebook are the two most available sources for me.
Yeah. In my 20s, which was a long time ago, I used to read a lot of existential philosophy. And not too long ago, I was on your Facebook page and I read something where you wrote that you're in a constant state of philosophical musing and you can read and learn philosophy on a scholastic level all you want, but none of it matters unless you don't experience it and have conversations about these things with others. So I'm curious, is there something, Danny, that you've recently read or experience that you really want to talk about with others?
So that perspective, I think for a lot of people who study philosophy, specifically like Western philosophy and more modern philosophy, might have a bit of a bone to pick with that statement. Because in a sense, what I'm saying is that like, I don't want to like undermine the great minds who have had amazing thoughts of engaging with, you know, reality and trying to understand reality objectively and break down, you know, concepts of the self and whatnot. And I think a lot of that thought process that I have when I made that statement wasn't to like be a hot take, but more of, so I've been a practicing Buddhist within the both Vajrayana and the Soto Zen school for about almost 20 years now. And one of the things that was a challenge for me so there's this word called Sangha, which means basically the community, right? And then Dharma space in a Buddhist space. So the people you engage with, like not the congregation, but it also can be like the world that you exist in, right? It's just, it's, but the smaller scope is like when I go to the center and I'm going to meditation and I'm meeting with like, you know, the monks and teachers in my community, that's the Sangha. And a couple years back, I was going through this period where I was reading a lot of Sartre and Camus and solipsism and Stoicism, and ever since I was really little, I've always had this like very deep hunger of knowing why. Like, and I mean that in like a big capital letter, why? Like, why this? Why me? Like, what is this? What am I? And I, throughout my whole life, have been very hungry to have that answer given to me. And one of the things that like really struck a chord with me was when I was very engaged in the center and meeting with like my teacher and my fellow community, you know, practitioners in Zen and in Vajrayana, which is Tibetan Buddhism, which is much more esoteric than Zen. They would basically disregard that question. They would say like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And I would get really frustrated with that. And I'm like, but that, like, why are we doing this? What is this? Like, who am I? What am I? Like, what is the foundation of reality and what is the foundation of self? And it wasn't until diving into meditation and to what's called, like, there's practices, like, in English would translate basically to, like, directly pointing at the mind, like Mahamudra or Dzogchen are two terms. And I'm not claiming that I'm enlightened by any means. That's not what I'm stating, because that would be ridiculous. Anyone who says that is somebody who should be very much like, you should be wary of. But my perspective changed, where I was going through all this like philosophy, and it was just feeding that need of that answer, because everybody had a different answer to something. It was completely subjective to each person, and all this great analytical thinking, but it's still a subjective experience. And I wanted objectivity. And it wasn't through like meditation that I started to realize that question really doesn't have an answer. It's already here. It's already where we are. Like in Zen, they say that like enlightenment is the cushion itself, right? Like nirvana is like entering the stream is like the daily practice. And I think I kind of realized that I was feeling less distance from philosophy over time, because there wasn't a need to have all this like constant circular thinking. It was already here. I think that's my answer to my first part. What was the second part to that you had?
Just maybe like, is there something like you've read recently or something that you want to experience that you feel like compelled to, that you want to talk about with other people?
So yeah, I grew up in an evangelical like household, and I found it really difficult to adapt to that. And I'm not, you know, this isn't coming from a place of judgment towards anybody in their particular belief system, because I am not a person to ever cast stones at other people for what they believe in. It's more of my own experience that I was never satisfied with the faith I grew up with. I found the concept of God to be very limiting and very a human construct. And if it did exist, it was something much, much, much larger and ineffable. And it was, as I grew older, I walked away from that completely. You know, I've always considered myself like a non-theistic person. There was a phrase that I heard a lot in Japanese while practicing Soto Zen. And there's a guy who is kind of like the foundational lineage holder of Zen, Soto Zen specifically, named Dogen. And Dogen wrote prolifically on meditation and on reality. And one of the things that he had talked about was that we are constantly kind of like paying attention to the words of things, of the scrutinizing language. And language can only get so far. And it's up to us as individuals to realize what those words mean. And there, for example, like Shakyamuni Buddha would talk a lot on these topics, and people would ask him questions. And one of the things that was very common was that they would ask particular questions and he wouldn't answer on them. He wouldn't even engage. He wouldn't ignore them. He would just kind of smile. And the response was that the question doesn't fit the case, right? Like the problem at hand, that question isn't relevant to it. And through my own kind of reading and stuff of Dogen, and other like Zen teachers, there's this like phrase, and Bruce Lee talked about it once, is that like, it makes sense that like in our experiences in life, we can't find happiness by reading about happiness. We can only find happiness by looking not at the symptom, but at the problem. If that's suffering created through attachment and delusion of experiences of self or the world around us, is that that perpetuates that. So for me, that finger pointing at the moon is rather than focusing on someone else's subjective explanation of something, experience what they're explaining. And that cuts out the middleman. And that, you know, is often takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time, and you got to be in a good place to be able to do internal, like, kind of analyzing. So yeah, I think for me, it's a prolific kind of explanation that am I going to be the source of creating a healthy version of me, or am I going to look on outside sources to create that for me? So it's like living authentically. Yeah.
I often think that, like, I've come to this physical space, whether we call it the earth, the universe, whatever, the world, to have new experiences. Like, a lot of times I'll see, like, you know, you go on social media every day, you can find, like, a new research study out about autism or the autistic experience. And I'll often joke with people privately, like, why did they spend all that time and money doing that? They could have just asked me. I would have told them that, you know? So
exactly.
And the only reason I say that is based on experience, right? Lived experience and all these experiences that we have.
I like that first part that you said a lot. You know, Carl Sagan once said that we're, you know, that every you know, atom in our body was born in the heart of a dying star. And when a star reaches critical mass and goes like supergiant or supernova, it expels all of the minerals that is created inside of it out. And over time, in millions and millions and millions of years, the same atoms that make up our body were born in the heart of a dying star. And he said that, you know, we are literally star stuff. And he goes on even more of what I consider like a very philosophical, almost kind of Buddhist perspective on that, is that we are a ways of which the universe to know itself. And I think that is a very beautiful kind of explanation that kind of bridges this like philosophical and scientific and spiritual kind of aspect all into one, that I think that there's a lot of things we spend a lot of time thinking about and trying to find answers to, myself included, very much so, when those answers are already right in front of us. And how can the subjective understand the objective if it doesn't realize that it is the objective? And what I mean by that is, like, when Carl Sagan says we're the universe, a way for the universe to know itself, is that, you know, we're just a small aperture of the bigger picture of all of reality experience itself for a period of time. You know, it's very much like that, the Vedanta, like in early Hinduism, talked about this a lot, of that the small experience of the self is really just the greater whole, like playing a role for a short period of time. And to me, I find that when that is known and experienced, it kind of breaks down this like barrier of like self and other, and becomes, you start to see the world in a very connective sort of way that I think autistic people are already, like, hardwired to already, like you mentioned. This is definitely a topic I could talk about for hours. And it's one of those things that's like, it's challenging to talk about, because like, I don't want to ever lead anybody like in the wrong direction. I am not a teacher in this. I am very much a student. I am working towards becoming a teacher. I've mentioned this on my page a couple of times, but I'm actually working towards ordination as becoming a monk myself. In Zen, that's very different than it is in, like, say, Thai Buddhism, of, like, you know, Theravada, where, like, it's very much separated from society, live in a monastery. And, you know, in Zen, it's very much more of the middle path of Mahayana, of being, you know, still a part of society. You know, Zen monks definitely are, you know, can get married and, you know, work their jobs and be associated, because they believe that that separation is harmful. And even then, I wouldn't be a teacher, you know. I've got a long way to go. But I can share my experiences if people are curious, you know. But I want to definitely emphasize that they are my experiences subjectively. So, yeah.
Well, when you do become a monk, Danny, I want you to come back here so we can have a discussion about that.
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Definitely never in a sense of proselytizing, because I grew up around that. I can't stand that. But, you know, people are curious.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. And it's funny, because like, I find that like, because I'm such a rational and logical person, and I think that if people aren't really familiar with like that kind of sense, it can seem a little like anti-theatrical to that, which But once you kind of like get a better understanding of it and that it's not a monolithic structure, that really at its heart is very logical and rational. And, you know, we're, you know, if we look back now in hindsight, the things that a lot of modern science is catching up with reflects those sort of knowledges from people. Think that people in the past were dumb, right? They think that they were like, you know, completely like unaware of like how things work. And that I think is seated in a lot of colonial and racist like thought. But people from, you know, we've been around a very long time. And a lot of the things that we're now discovering, we weren't the first to figure that out. You know, when it comes to psychology and physics, like a lot of ancient cultures, like we're aware of things and it's just been lost over time. But yeah, it's pretty fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much to Danny for the conversation. Check out later this month for part two of our wonderful conversation. At Autism Personal Coach, we provide customized coaching for autistics. All of our coaches are either autistic or autistic selected for their commitment to trauma-informed and neurodiversity-affirming strategies. They deeply understand burnout, sensory needs, executive functioning, and the importance of special interests. If you're interested in learning more about our coaching, please visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories, and if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone you know about it, so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.